in Palestine.
Hello, everyone. So you can stretch with me now, just a little bit. Yes, up here. So imagine you're on a plane. Actually, it's probably more crowded than that. I know you've been sitting very patiently here, and I'll try to be brief. I was having my physical checkup last week, and the doctor, clearly not used to having more than 10-minute appointments, wanted to have some small talk, asked me what I do. I teach modern history, the history of the modern Middle East, and she looked at me as if the question has been on her mind for a very, very, very long time. She says, "Why can't they get along?" That's the, I think that's the question on most people's minds, actually, who rely on television news for their information. There are studies that show the more television news you watch, the less you know. I'm being very serious, and I do derive some hope in the fact that 16% of Americans actually read printed news, of which a very small portion, I'm sure, goes beyond the comics and so on. There is a serious problem about information in this country, and if I was to sit here for the next 15 minutes to tell you exactly what you hear is not really what's going on the ground, I would never get a chance to actually sort of provide a different perspective, an alternative perspective to understanding things. So I'm not going to spend much time sort of deconstructing what you think you know, and rather tell you through a bunch of little stories what's really going on in Palestine today and how it's related to the war in Lebanon. First of all, what happened this summer is an historic watershed. Not since 1967 have we gone through a period which really will redefine the politics of the region for the next generation or two. 1967 signaled the ascendance of U.S. and Israeli power in the region when Israel defeated a number of Arab countries within 6 days. 2006 signals the beginning and of, in the, I think, irreversible trend in the other direction. So it is in all of our interests to become informed about the realities of the Middle East and how we can play a role in making sure that this irreversible trend towards negotiation, because obviously the major lesson of this war is that you cannot resolve rooted political conflicts through military means. The long road towards negotiations over the next generation or two has to be done in the spirit of, one, being informed about what's really going on, and in this country that takes a bit of work, and two, learning how to be critical of your own identity as a beginning point towards understanding the other. The answer I gave to the doctor is, because I had to put it in one sentence, of course, is that they can't get along because what we're involved in is a decades-long process of the dispossession of one people by another. And that process not only has not ended, it is intensifying. That is to say, they can get along not because they are two neighbors with a line down in the lawn separating the property of one from the other, and then they get into these irrational feuds like the Hatfields and the McCoys. Rather, imagine somebody coming into your house, stuffing all your family in the bathroom, and then reducing the size of the bathroom inch by inch over a 30-40 year period, and meanwhile calling you the terrorist for resisting that occupation. That is what is going on in Palestine today. Why is it, then I must ask myself, does the world allow a process of what essentially is a demographic and territorial displacement against all conventions of international law to continue in your face for all of these years? And there's no better testimony to that than the fact that 1.5 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip lived through their worst moments ever. The nightmare of the occupation times 10 during the period of the war in Lebanon, and it hardly made the 14th page news. This process of demographic and territorial displacement has been accompanied lately by an increasing process of ghettoization, literal ghettoization, in the sense that you erect barriers and walls around population centers and you watch over them with gun turrets and pilotless drones. Along with, as we can see in Gaza, a process of brutal repression. How can this go on when there has been, for at least 40 years now, a clear and overwhelming international consensus on how to resolve this conflict, which is the Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian territories that has occupied in 1967? Well, the obvious answer is it goes on because it can. Israel has the full support of the United States, and that is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, international law and brutalize another people without being held accountable or having to pay a price for it. On the other hand, it leads to a certain kind of arrogance of power which forces this government to commit the same mistake over and over again. That is to say, to resolve in their mind a whole host of complex political issues through massive shows of force. After all, you would think that Israel would have learned from its 1982 invasion of Lebanon, which lasted over 3 months, in which they surrounded an Arab capital that they bombarded from the air, the sea, and land, in which over 20,000 Lebanese were killed, and which was sort of climaxed by the infamous Sabra Shatila massacre, when the Israeli army allowed right-wing death squads to come into Palestinian refugee camps, which had been emptied of their fighters, with mostly women and children, and over a three-day period provided nighttime lights through flares to allow the killing to continue, and bulldozers to dig large pits so these bodies can be dumped in to hide the crime. And the person responsible was none other than Ariel Sharon, who, I must say, became subject to the largest outbreak of peace movement that Israel has ever seen, when 400,000 Israelis went on the streets at a time when Israel was still at war and said, this is a war of choice. This is a brutal and illegal war, and we want our soldiers out. And in fact, a commission was established which found Sharon indirectly, quote unquote, responsible for the massacres, and he was forced out of his job. Compare this with what happened with this latest invasion. All of Sharon was the architect of the first war. All of his goals for the first war were not achieved. Instead of destroying the Palestinian National Movement by force, actually the Palestinian National Movement in the 80s culminated in this largest show of force through the first Intifada, and Israel had to deal with it politically in the end through the Oslo process. He wanted to get the Syrians out of Lebanon. The Syrians entrenched their presence in Lebanon after the war, he wanted to install a puppet Lebanese government under leadership of one of those death squad leaders, Bashir Ismail, and he was promptly assassinated, and a new government came into being, which made null and void the agreements that this person had already signed with Israel, the May Agreement. All the goals of Israel in the 82 invasion were not achieved, and still Israel stayed in Lebanon until 2000. It was defeated and forced to leave Lebanon, and yet again, in 2006, an Israeli government comes in and says, we're going to resolve this whole problem through a massive show and force, and they utterly fail. Every single objective that the State of Israel made public, and all the ones that were not public, were not achieved by this war. So I'm arguing that there's a certain irrationality in the kind of violence that we see that has to do with the arrogance of power. Now, three quick examples. The invasion and reoccupation of Gaza that we saw take place over the last 2 months, which has led to the killing of close to 250 Palestinians, a third of them children and women, which began with the destruction of the infrastructure, beginning with the bridges, and then the power stations, and the roads, and the various institutions of government, and so on, which continued through an air and land and sea siege, just like in Lebanon, which turned Gaza into a tightly sealed open-air prison. The politics of indiscriminate shelling of civilian neighborhoods in order to force people not to support the resistance movement, which has always backfired in the past, continues to backfire in Gaza as well. We see all these similarities of what Israel has done in Lebanon with what was happening in Gaza. But the larger story here is that Gaza was supposed to be the showcase of the so-called convergence plan, in which Israel would unilaterally withdraw from Palestinian territories, sort of a gracious giveaway of land in order to say, you're there, and we're here, and there's a border in the middle, and we're done. This is exactly the way that they left Lebanon in 2000. That is to say, without negotiating with the Lebanese government what happens to the still disputed lands of Mazar al-Sheba, Sheba Farms, without negotiating what the relations between the two will be, rather a unilateral withdrawal and a pretense in front of the world that the issue has been resolved. In fact, the reoccupation of Gaza and the current violence that's going on there now is a structural feature of that withdrawal plan. Because Israel did not really withdraw so much from Gaza as it turned it into from a prison of many rooms into a one-room prison, which is all of which is completely controlled by Israel. Two other quick examples of how this process of dispossession and through basically demographic territorial displacement is going on as we speak, because there are wars and there are armies and there are negotiations and diplomatic maneuvers and so on. But on the ground, every day, there's a relentless march of that demographic and territorial displacement. Palestinians who marry Israeli citizens are not allowed to live with their spouses. That is a law that was passed in Israel not long ago, during just before the summer, in fact. That is to say, if an Israeli citizen who happens to be not Jewish, a Palestinian, marries, let's say, a Palestinian who lives in the West Bank, that person cannot move in, cannot have residency. And that is applied selectively only to Palestinians. Okay. Not long ago, also, a new procedure was set up at the borders that would not allow Palestinians who have U.S. citizenship from entering Israel or having residency there. There are thousands of people finding themselves in a similar position as Sam Bahour, who is a Palestinian businessman who has come from a Ramallah family. His family has been there for generations. He happened to be out of the country in 1967 when the war broke out, and any Palestinian that was out of the country was not allowed a Israeli-issued ID, which would allow that person to actually live there. They would have to become a visitor. But he went back, and he married, and he has children. He's been living there for a very long time. He's afraid to leave the country because they would not allow him back. He has instead to apply for renewal of a visa, which the last time he tried to get that visa, instead of the customary 3 months visa, he was given a 1 month visa, and under it said last renewal. There are thousands and thousands of families that will be split apart, have been split apart as a result of this new procedure. If you live in Jerusalem and you happen to be Palestinian, and you get a job in the United States, and you are gone for more than 3 years, when you get back, you'll be asked to renew your ID card. And when it is being renewed, they'll say, where have you lived the last 3 years? Well, in Jerusalem? No. Well, sorry, you no longer have Jerusalem residency. These kinds of measures, along with a very complicated system of population control and how people can move from one place to the other, is creating a situation which makes it impossible to achieve a two-state solution. So we are looking at a future where there are no clear political formulas that seem to be achievable, and at the same time, a situation in which the use of force has proved itself to be completely ineffective. And we are being asked, I think, and we should ask ourselves, of how we can creatively think of ways to reverse the situation and achieve a peaceful resolution. And it must begin with stopping this process, this ongoing process of dispossession. That is the engine that is moving the entire conflict, and that is the heart of tensions in the Middle East. And the sooner that the Israeli government realizes that it's in its best interests to reverse this process, there's a saying that says, Iranian, I believe, that no matter how far and how long you've been going the wrong direction, it's not too late to turn back. Thank you.